Coming up on Tech Nation, good questions and bad ones, fair questions and unfair ones as well. I have my own questions for Warren Berger, who's here with the 10th anniversary re-release and update of A More Beautiful Question, The Power of Inquiry to Spark Breakthrough Ideas. Then, now that we can see the presence of individual cancer cells in our blood, Elicio Therapeutics is working to knock out cancer cells and have you ready to fight them in the future, should they reappear. I speak with Elicio's Dr. Peter DeMuth. All this coming up on this week's Tech Nation.
Let's Take 5 with Moira Gunn. This is 5 Minutes.
In 2012, I interviewed National Medal of Technology winner Ray Kurzweil about his book, How to Create a Mind, The Secret of Human Thought Revealed. In it, he writes, the story of human intelligence starts with a universe that is capable of encoding information. We have a world based on information, and he's not talking about the digital kind.
There's a lot of debate as to how we ended up in the universe that can encode information. Some people use the anthropic principle that if it wasn't the case, we wouldn't be here and wouldn't be talking about it. But that allowed evolution, and evolution has evolved more and more complex creatures that eventually evolved a nervous system. And those nervous systems ultimately evolved a neocortex, which is capable of thinking in hierarchies to reflect the natural hierarchy of the world. This first emerged in mammals. It was the size of a postage stamp and as thin as a postage stamp, and little rodents, not very noticeable, but it allowed these animals to actually learn new skills that were complicated and hierarchical without having to go through thousands of years of biological evolution to change their behavior. But then, 65 million years ago, there was this cataclysmic event called the Cretaceous Extinction Event, and we can see archaeological evidence of that everywhere in the world. Something happened very dramatic to change the environment very quickly. And animals, non-mammalian species that did not have a neocortex, died out. Many of them did. And that's when mammals took over this ecological niche. And to anthropomorphize, biological evolution said, hey, this neocortex is pretty useful. And they start growing it as mammals got more complex. And by primates, it was no longer flat, it was very convoluted. If you know what the brain of a primate looks like, it has many ridges and convolutions to increase its surface area. It's still a very thin structure. If you were to stretch out a human neocortex, it'd be about the size of a table napkin and just as thin. But because of all of these curvatures and convolutions, it's about 80% of the brain. And it's where we do our thinking, and we think in hierarchies. And the big innovation in Homo sapiens is we have this big forehead. We could squeeze in more neocortex, and that was the enabling factor that permitted the development of language. Art and science and music, no other invention, technology, no other species does that. Other primates began to do a little bit of it. They have some primitive language and tool-making skills, but only humans can really build this fantastic hierarchy. And now we're actually using that scientific ability to understand the best example of human intelligence, which is the human brain. And it's really only in the last couple of years that we can see inside a human brain with enough precision to see what's going on. And we can see our brain create our thoughts. We can see our thoughts create our brain. That's key to how the neocortex works. The connections between these different pattern recognition modules, which is part of my thesis, that represents the hierarchy of our concepts, we create ourselves. From the moment we're born and even before that, we're laying down this conceptual hierarchy from very primitive recognitions like the crossbar and a capital A or the edge of an object up to things like, she's pretty, you know, that was ironic. They're actually done by the same recognizers, except that those high-level recognizers exist at the top of this conceptual hierarchy. And the hierarchy is created by actual wiring of actual dendrites and axons between these different modules. I estimated we have about 300 million pattern recognizers. They each have about 100 neurons. So the basic unit is not a neuron. It's a module of about 100 neurons that can recognize a pattern and that can build these connections to other modules.
You've been listening to a 2012 TechNation interview with Ray Kurzweil, the author of How to Create a Mind, The Secret of Human Thought Revealed. Today, Ray Kurzweil is the chief futurist at Google. I'm Moira Gunn. This is 5 Minutes.
5 Minutes is produced at the studios of KQED-FM in San Francisco. 5 Minutes is a production of TechNation Media. I'm Paul Lancour.
From San Francisco, I'm Moira Gunn, and this is Tech Nation. Today on Tech Nation, Warren Berger is here to answer questions about his book, A More Beautiful Question, now in its 10th anniversary, re-release and update. And Dr. Peter DeMuth, the Chief Scientific Officer of Elicio Therapeutics. He'll tell us about Elicio's approach to build on the new technology which can detect the presence of cancer cells in your blood and which can also monitor the success of their treatment to fight individual cancer cells both now and in the future should they return.
TechNation is underwritten in part by MindK, a global software development force in a world where every business can be global. On the web at mindk.com.
And now, Warren Berger. Warren, welcome to Tech Nation.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Now, in your book, you talk about asking why, what if, and how. Why? Now, there's a why question. Why those three questions? Why do they lead to breakthrough innovations?
Yeah, I sort of stumbled on that as I was researching the book, just looking through lots of innovation stories and noticing certain patterns. And the patterns were that innovations do often start with someone asking why. They're asking, you know, why hasn't someone come up with a better way to do this? Or why is it that every time I, you know, use this product, I have this problem? And it sort of kickstarts the process of innovation. But then what I noticed is, you know, just asking why is not enough, because why is about trying to understand something. Okay, so when you're asking why, you're trying to understand what's going on here, what's the problem, right? Why is this a problem? But just understanding is not enough. If you're going to change things, you have to begin to actually do something. So I found the second stage for a lot of innovators was what if, because what they have to do once they understand something is they have to start to use their imagination and say, okay, I understand the problem. What if we try this or what if we try that? You know, when you're asking what if, you're sort of creating alternate realities. And then the last thing is how. You know, once you've sort of used your imagination to come up with ideas, you have to get practical. You know, you have to say, okay, how are we actually going to do this? Which of these ideas is the best and how are we going to make it happen?
Now, you're a journalist, a writer. You've done extensive work. And I want to say you've gone beyond just reporting on. You've done extensive work in entrepreneurship, in innovation, in creativity. And you published some dozen books over the years. Yet the first time you came on my radar was actually 10 years ago with this book. This book started 10 years ago, and now Bloomsbury is republishing it, both congratulations, and it's expanded and updated. What's expanded? What's updated? What have you learned in the last 10 years?
Oh, my, everything has changed, you know. So that's why I was realizing that if they were going to do a revised edition on the 10th anniversary, normally you would just, you know, update things, you know, say this has changed. Okay, I'm going to change this date. I'm going to change this little fact here or there. But I realized, you know, we'd gone through the pandemic. We'd gone through tremendous social change, tremendous political change. There were all these things going on in the world that I felt like it changed the whole nature of the book. So I still wanted to talk about innovation, and I still wanted to be a big part of the book. But I feel like that kind of the obsession with innovation is now accompanied by, you know, all kinds of other concerns we have of, you know, how are we going to get along with each other? How is our democracy going to survive? You know, little things like that. And it occurred to me that questioning is such a big part of all of that. It's central to, you know, critical thinking. It's central to the way we communicate with each other, especially when we don't necessarily agree. So I felt like I wanted to address all of these things in the new book. So I added a new chapter on critical thinking. I added a new chapter on using questions to try to communicate and influence people. And then a new chapter on leadership. I sort of make the case that we need questioning leaders today.
Well, there's a lot to go into here. I mean, asking questions is actually very human. It's a uniquely human activity. You suggesting that, hey, you know, some people ask questions to sow confusion and misinformation. How do you tell the difference? Something that could be used for good could also be used for bad.
Yeah, that was a kind of a learning experience for me, because when I wrote the first edition of this book, I was very much of the belief that questioning is just this universally great thing.
Oh, you naive person, you.
Yeah, you know, I believed in that sort of the George, you know, I'm a big fan of the comedian George Carlin. And George Carlin used to say, you know, question everything and teach your kids to question everything. And then I'm a fan of Carl Sagan and people like that. And they all said, you know, you have to question everything. So then we get into the, you know, the period of the pandemic, and suddenly people are questioning, you know, the policies that are being put forward and the what's going on in the pandemic and all of this stuff. And did that school shooting actually really happen, or was it all a fake, or was it a hoax? And I started to realize, you know, questioning can easily go off the rails. And that's kind of what also led me into the critical thinking chapter, because I wanted to figure out, if critical thinking is all based in questions, what is the difference between the questions you should be asking and the ones you shouldn't? And a lot of times what it comes down to is just your attitude and your mindset as you're asking questions. The biggest thing is open-mindedness. You can be asking skeptical questions about anything, about the government, about the pandemic, about vaccines, whatever, but you have to be doing so with an open mind. And that is really the key. You have to understand that whatever you get back from these questions, you have to be willing to accept it. You know, not only the stuff that you want to hear, but the stuff that contradicts maybe what you believe. So that's kind of the key to critical thinking, is not only knowing what questions to ask, but doing so with the right attitude and the right mindset.
I have to say, you sort of put me back on my heels here, because people have always said to me, hey, what makes a good question? How do you do all these interviews? What makes a good question? And I always say, you know, the best questions are those in which the listener actually learns something just listening to the question. And then I read your book, absolutely, and thought, uh-oh, you know, I've always put real facts in those questions. It's like you could seed the question with something completely misleading or mischaracterizing or misframing. And the person's asked a question, you know, have you stopped beating your wife, is the classic, you know, they all, it's like, I don't have a wife, I never beat her. It's like, he denies beating his wife. You know, it's like, what? It's like, how do we recognize those? I mean, I think you could, as you say, it's like, basically just tell the truth and be open. But how do you recognize when it comes at you that perhaps there's an agenda there or something that's disingenuous or not authentic?
Yeah, I think you're looking for, it's sort of what you're getting at there. You're looking for the answer within the question. Like someone has already put the answer, you know, or suggested the answer inside the question. Okay, let me put it this way. I think one of the most important ingredients of a question is curiosity. right? So if there's curiosity in a question, you can sort of tell. You know, you can kind of tell when someone's asking you a question that has curiosity behind it. And what I find with a lot of people who misuse questioning, like these, you know, pundits and provocateurs who are asking these questions that they don't believe it, that they don't, they, you know, it's all fake. It's all agenda driven, but they're doing it just so that they can cover themselves by saying, hey, I put that crazy idea out into the world, but I'm just asking questions. That's all. I'm allowed to ask questions. And so the way you recognize that is to look for not only what's in it, which is they may be embedding answers within the question that they want you to pick up on, but also to look for what's missing. And what's missing is curiosity. You know, what's missing, you can tell this person already knows what they think the answer is.
And may not even care what you say. They've gotten out. They've seeded their idea.
Absolutely.
Or their version of the facts. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. So they're using it as a device. And I call those counterfeit questions, you know, counterfeit questions. And not only the pundits are using those, but we use those in our daily lives. You know, when we go up to someone and say, what were you thinking when you did that? You know, that's not really a curious question. You know, we're not really wondering what the person was thinking. We're using it as a way to criticize them, right? So I'm very much on the lookout for...
But it's fair game.
Yeah.
It's fair game if it was your teenage son and it did it with your car.
Right.
It's like, what were you thinking?
And so the question becomes just a way to state something, to criticize someone, that kind of thing. And those are the kind of questions I really am on the lookout for. I don't like them.
And we should be listening for that. You're listening to Tech Nation. I'm Moira Gunn, and my guest today is Warren Berger. He's published some dozen books over the years, including with Alan Siegel and Irene Exkron, Simple, Conquering the Crisis of Complexity. He's here today with the 10th anniversary re-release and update and expansion of A More Beautiful Question, The Power of Inquiry to Spark Breakthrough Ideas. Well, in another vein of hearing something within the question that might be off pace, you know, in Silicon Valley, we like to say, you know, we eat failure for breakfast. And it's okay to fail here. You won't be shunned. You know, it's just like, did you learn? What did you do? Go forward. But a lot of people don't like to fail, or they have a real fear of failing. You know, it's just sort of in there. How does fear of failing affect the questions that we ask? And can we hear it in it?
Yeah, I think, you know, what fear of failure does is it limits our questions. It limits the scope of our questions oftentimes. So we sort of pull back or we rein in what we might ask. And the idea is with innovation, at least in the early stages, you want to be thinking big. You know, you want to be opening up the widest range of possibilities of what you might do. So I think that's one reason why you see people in Silicon Valley and innovators gravitate toward questions like, there was a question that sort of became very popular in Silicon Valley in recent years and was passed around by everyone. And the question was, what would we do if we couldn't fail? If failure was not possible, then what would we try? So I think of that as a way that you try to put failure aside temporarily so that you can think as boldly and as big as possible. Now, at some point, you have to come back to reality and realize that, yeah, failure is a possibility, but just for a little while, you want to take it off the table. And you want to be able to think in the boldest way possible. And so that's one thing you can do. And just, you know, in terms of fear of failure, you know, there's the classic question that everyone's mother asks them at some point or another, which is, what's the worst that could happen? You know, and that actually is a great question. And it's a question we should often ask ourselves when we're about to, you know, take on a challenge or embark on something, it's a way to kind of remind yourself that, you know, the things that could go wrong, if you really analyze and think about them, they're probably not as bad in reality as they are in your imagination. And that's what that question does. It sort of forces you to deal with the kind of the scared feelings you have in your imagination that may not be real or justified.
Now, let me ask you this. How do you feel about people who start off their questions with, let me be the devil's advocate here?
I have very mixed feelings about devil's advocate questions because, as I mentioned earlier, I like questions that are rooted in curiosity. And the devil's advocate question sometimes is, but sometimes it is simply there to kind of create mischief or to sort of create opposition just for the sake of opposition, you know? And I don't like it when it's used that way. I think it all depends on how it's used. If you're using it to explore the widest range of options, or if you're using it just to say, hey, I want to make sure you have considered this this alternate point of view, you know, that there may be a problem associated with what you're suggesting, and I just want to make sure you're aware of it. So if you're doing it with that kind of tone, then I think it's okay. But there are people out there who just, they do it way too much. They play devil's advocate way too much. And I think it's because they're sort of contrarians.
Yeah, exactly. Taking the group off into another direction, wasting people's time.
Yeah.
And if it fails, they've actually, I said there could be a problem here.
Right. That's right. That's right.
they got themselves covered. What do they care?
You know, yeah.
What do they
either
care?
Way. Yep.
Now, you did bring up critical thinking. And, you know, sort of the further you get away from school and somebody makes you think and, you know, grade you on it, or we don't actually put ourselves through critical thinking training anymore. Well, we're adults. We can think about things. Let's go to critical thinking. What do you mean by that? What does an adult do when they're exercising critical thinking?
Well, I think of it as two parts. There's sort of an internal part and a more of an external part, where the internal part is of critical thinking is thinking about your own thinking, you know, and sort of which is challenging. It's not easy to think about your own thinking, but you're trying to say to yourself, okay, what are my biases? Where do I tend to lean on certain issues? You're trying to figure, why do I believe what I believe? You know, that's sort of the jugular question, I call it in my book. Why do I believe what I believe? And we rarely stop and analyze that. We rarely stop and think about it. So one of the ways you do critical thinking is to just kind of get yourself to think about your own thinking, your own biases, so that you can bring that to the table as you encounter new ideas. And you can say to yourself, well, you know, I have a tendency to be a little bit, to lean a little bit this way on the issue. I'm going to try to look at this with a very objective point of view. And I may even challenge myself by saying, what would be the opposite way of looking at this issue? What would someone who thinks differently than I do, how might they see this issue? So these are like exercises you can do with yourself to sort of open up your mind and your thinking a little bit. So that to me that's part one, is just sort of focusing on your own thinking and trying to open it up as much as you can. And then part two is, you know, there's stuff coming at us every day, stories, claims, all kinds of information we're getting swamped with it. Just getting yourself to stop and ask questions like, what's the evidence behind this claim? What seems to be the evidence? Is it solid? Does there seem to be an agenda behind it? Is there logic? Is there logic behind it? And again, think about opposing viewpoints. You know, this story is trying to tell me this point of view. What would be the opposite way of looking at this? And so you're always trying to get yourself to shift to opposite views. And so that's what we need to almost train ourselves to get in the habit of doing as we encounter new information and new, and everything from politicians' claims to the story, a news story you're reading on the internet. You know, you need to bring these kind of, you know, analytical questions to it.
Now, you mentioned leadership, and I enjoyed reading that chapter. We don't really think about it in terms of questioning. What is a fair question that a leader can ask, and what would be an unfair question?
I think of an unfair question or a sort of a useless question, which leaders are always asking is, you know, they're always looking at a situation in a company and they're saying, what's the problem here? And whose fault is it? And, you know, what are we doing wrong here? And so what they're doing when they do that is they're framing questions in a very negative way. They're always framing them around problems. You know, they're always asking about problems. And yes, it's true. You do have problems that you have to deal with in a company. But a lot of times, if you are framing things in terms of problems, it creates a real negative vibe. It creates a kind of a blame culture. And so what leaders really should be doing is trying to shift their questions into a more positive tone. You know, it's as simple as saying, you know, what are we doing right here? And where can we improve? As opposed to focusing on, you know, how are we messing up? So that's one of the things they do. They really need to lean towards something that there's a term for this called appreciative inquiry. And appreciative inquiry is really about trying to build your questions as much as you can around positive elements. The other thing they should be doing is they just should be getting out there into the workplace and into the organization and asking people, you know, what are the challenges we're facing here? You know, what do you need from me as a leader? How can I help? That's considered to be the ultimate leader question, is how can I help, right? But you better mean it if you ask it. Like, you better be willing to back it up, because someone is going to tell you, well, you know, I could really use help in this area, and our department is really struggling with this one issue. And if you just walk away and don't do anything about it, you know, then you've wasted an opportunity, and you've probably trained people to stop sharing that kind of information with you, because they'll realize, oh, it doesn't do any good. So that's kind of what questioning leaders need to do. And it's a whole different style of leadership. It's very out there, and it's a contact sport. You know, you're out there and talking to people in a way that you're not in your corner office cut off from everyone. You're not just telling people the answers or what to do. You're out there asking and wondering and listening.
I'm speaking with Warren Berger, the author of A More Beautiful Question, now in its 10th anniversary re-release, update, and expansion. We'll talk more after a break. Both Whole Tech Nation programs and biotech-only interviews are available wherever you get your podcasts. For more information, technation.com or biotechnation.com. In the second half of our show, detecting a relapsing cancer early as in individual cells found circulating in your blood, and how Elicio Therapeutics is working to go after that cancer cell by cell. Stay with us. You're listening to Tech Nation. I've been speaking with Warren Berger about the 10th anniversary re-release and update of his book, A More Beautiful Question. I have another question for him. Now, we've been talking about, you know, organizations and your team and leadership, but we've also been talking about, you know, critical thinking about, oh, what do I think and have I really gotten this? And we've almost gotten to the question I'm about to ask. It's like, we kind of came close and then we just kind of steered away. And that question is, when we look at these questioning principles, and can we apply them to asking questions about ourselves and our own behaviors and our own thinking and our own values? Can we direct them to ourselves?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that's one of the most important ways we should be using questioning. You know, I was kind of hoping that during the pandemic, when everyone was forced to slow down, you know, that that might be a time when people would finally have an opportunity to ask themselves some really deep questions about, you know, where they're going with their lives. Are they happy with the direction? I think, unfortunately, for a lot, at least in terms of talking to people, a lot of people, they sort of intended to do that, but somehow never did. They ended up, you know, just filling their time with something else, you know, getting on Netflix or whatever. And so my theory is that part of the reason is that maybe we don't ask like deeper questions of ourselves, even when we have time. We don't have the excuse of, oh, I don't have time, you know, because we're forced to slow down. Even then we don't do it. And I think the reason might be that we're not comfortable with asking ourselves sort of deeper questions. And we're not comfortable with asking questions that don't have an answer, you know, and that's an issue, right? Because the questions, the really important questions you're likely to ask yourself, or you should be asking yourself, they don't have quick and easy answers. They usually involve a journey. You know, you ask the question and then you think about it for a long time and you play around with one idea and you talk to people and eventually a long time later, you may have the big insight. Oh, this is what I should be doing, but it's not going to happen right away necessarily. And so I think there's a little discomfort with that uncertainty, right? I'm going to ask a question, but I'm not going to have an answer. So I think one of the first things we need to do is get comfortable with that uncertainty. And we need to realize, you know, take a lesson from these innovators who ask big questions. They don't have the answer when they ask that question. When they ask that question about how can I make a better this or a better that, they don't have the answer. But it's a journey. The question starts them on a journey, and then eventually, if they're lucky, they get to the answer, they get to the breakthrough. And it's kind of the same for us in our lives. I mean, we have to be willing to ask these big questions about where do I want to go and what do I really want to do? And we have to know that it may take us a while to get there.
You don't even have to have the answer yet.
No way.
But ask yourself the question.
The question will get you started. The question will get you on the journey. That's one of the great things that questions do. You know, they get your brain working on something. You may not even realize your brain's thinking about it. But once you've asked that question, your unconscious mind is starting to play with this idea and saying, oh, what about this? What about that?
But whatever you do, don't start with playing devil's advocate here. Big waste of
right.
time.
Yeah.
Big waste of time. Warren, thank you so much for joining me. I hope you come back. See us again.
Oh, I'd love to come back. And great questions, by the way.
Thank you. Thank you. My guest today is Warren Berger in its 10th anniversary re-release and update. Is A More Beautiful Question, The Power of Inquiry to Spark Breakthrough Ideas, is published by Bloomsbury. I'm Moira Gunn. You're listening to Tech Nation. There are few things more anxiety-producing than having to go in and get a scan to see if your cancer may have returned. And thankfully, scans do pick up tiny tumors. But what if we could see characteristics of that cancer much earlier, while they were simply individual cancer cells? And what if that ability might lead directly to a treatment or even a vaccine, recognizing and eliminating those cells should they appear in the future? Today, we learn how Elicio Therapeutics is working to do just that. Dr. Peter DeMuth is its chief scientific officer. Dr. DeMuth, welcome to the program.
Thank you. It's great to be here, Moira.
Now, I've been thinking about a place to start, and I'm hoping this is the right place. You know, we've all heard about DNA, but you use the term ctDNA. What is ctDNA?
Yeah, that's a great place to start. So ctDNA stands for circulating tumor DNA, and this is DNA that is released by tumor cells that might be present in the body. And some of this DNA, when it's released, is able to make its way into the blood. And then it can be detected with a specialized test that analyzes a patient's blood. And these tests are really interesting because they're based upon a DNA signature that's found in the tumor. It's specific for the tumor, almost like a fingerprint. So these tests are designed to work by detecting that DNA signature of the tumor in the blood so that if we see this fingerprint in the blood test, it tells us that a tumor is present somewhere in the body.
Now, is this new technology? Have we been using it for some time? Where are we with this?
It's relatively new. We're definitely seeing progress, and these types of tests are being designed and perfected over time. So we're looking to improve the way that we can detect cancer using these ctDNA tests. And the other really interesting opportunity is to use them to inform the treatments that we design for patients. So taking a big step back, right now, most of the time, cancer patients are diagnosed using medical imaging techniques. And this can give us important information about a tumor, can show it us where it is or how advanced it is. And it can even be used once patients are on treatment so that we can monitor the tumor and it can tell us whether the cancer is responding to a particular therapy. Is it getting bigger? Is it getting smaller? Is it completely gone? So imaging is really useful, but these ctDNA tests could be used in many of the same ways to detect a tumor, to learn something about the tumor, to understand if a treatment is working. But the ctDNA tests have some really important advantages. So this might help us to treat cancer more effectively. One of the big advantages is that because ctDNA tests use blood, they can be more convenient than going for repeated medical imaging. But also, and this is the big one, ctDNA tests can be extremely sensitive. So for example, medical imaging might only be able to detect a tumor that is about a centimeter in size. But since ctDNA tests are based on DNA, they might be able to detect the presence of a much smaller tumor that would not ordinarily show up on a medical scan. And the reason this is important is because with cancer, treating early when a tumor is small and more manageable gives us the best chance to be successful. So overall, it's really exciting to see these tests being used more often and in different ways. And I think that could really help improve patient care.
Now, do we have to know the tumor profile, the tumor DNA for a particular person to compare it, to see it in the blood?
Yeah, many of these tests are built upon an analysis of the tumor that's done early on when a patient is first diagnosed. And then that information is used to develop the fingerprint that I mentioned, the signature of the tumor. And that signature is what is analyzed in the blood. So some of those tests are built on that concept, but others use more basic information that is shared and common across many different tumors and many different patients.
So let's say I have cancer surgery. If all the cancer is removed, then we should not see any ctDNA in my blood, right?
That's exactly right. So if a tumor is truly completely removed by surgery or it's destroyed by a therapy that's effective, there would be no tumor cells left in the body to produce that ctDNA. And in that case, the ctDNA test would be negative. It would show no detectable levels of ctDNA or presence of that tumor signature in the blood.
And going on from here, if there are cells that are remaining, will they continue to grow and we eventually see their ctDNA?
Absolutely. And I can give you a really good example of this. So one area where ctDNA tests are being used is to evaluate patients after surgery. So of course, the goal of surgery is to completely remove the cancer, but realistically, that can be very difficult to do. So ctDNA can give us a very sensitive tool to determine whether there's tumor remaining after surgery. So if ctDNA is present, we refer to that as molecular relapse. So this is because we can see the signature of the tumor on a molecular level. And this is often at a point where standard medical imaging may not be able to detect that tumor at all. So by using this approach, we've seen that patients with molecular relapse after surgery, they're more likely to develop that visible tumor on their scans. And this happens much more quickly compared to patients that don't have detectable ctDNA after surgery. So having this information gives us a really good opportunity to treat these patients earlier when the overall amount of tumor is small. And the goal is to see that ctDNA level decrease or, best case scenario, go away completely. And if we're able to achieve that, the expectation is that we could prevent recurrence of the tumor and patients might have longer and healthier lives.
Now let's get to what Elicio is doing. What are you doing?
Yeah, so till now we've talked about how we can determine the DNA signature of a tumor as part of that ctDNA test. But the tumor signature is important in other ways. For example, it could give us clues about what parts of the tumor we can target with treatment. For example, what parts of the tumor differentiate it from normal healthy cells? And these differences could be really good targets for a potential treatment. So our goal at Elicio is to use that information, that signature of the tumor, to train the immune cells of the body. Essentially, we want the body's own immune cells to use that tumor signature to identify cancer cells specifically and then to destroy them. And it's probably helpful to pause here and say something quickly about the immune system. We talk about the immune system, what we really mean is the millions of immune cells that are present in our bodies. And there are different types of immune cells. Each cell type has a function and a job. And overall, these cells work together to protect us from infectious disease, bacteria, from viruses. But they can also protect us from our own cells if they become mutated and have the potential to become cancer. So one of the jobs of the immune response is to detect these mutated cells, and ideally to kill them before they're able to become cancer. And one particular type of immune cell I want to mention is important for this. Some people may know these as T cells, but if not, what you need to know about these cells is that they patrol throughout the body. Part of their job is to recognize the mutations that develop in cancerous cells. In other words, they could detect if a cell has that signature or that fingerprint that's associated with cancer. And with the right training, they can search out and destroy those cells. So to bring it all back, the idea at Elicio is to design treatments that can train these immune cells so they can first recognize that cancer signature and have the ability to kill those cancerous cells wherever they find them in the body.
So you're smartening up these T cells, these immune cells, and they're all over your body looking.
That's exactly right.
I feel like my body's so smart. Make your body smarter. It could be your motto.
We often call the lymph nodes the schoolhouse of the immune system for that exact reason. We're taking these immune cells to school.
Now, you just mentioned your lymph nodes. What do they have to do with these immune cells, these T cells you're smartening up?
That's a great point, Moira, and I'll get to that. Let me first start by talking to you about these signatures a little bit more. One of the main signatures that we're looking for in the cancers that we're trying to treat is called KRAS. KRAS is a mutation present in many different tumors. It's part of that tumor signature. In fact, it's present in about 25% of all human solid cancers, including pancreatic and colorectal and lung cancers. And in total, these mutations affect cancers that are present in hundreds of thousands of patients in the US every year. So if we could design a treatment that would take those immune cells to school, train them up so that they recognize that mutant form of KRAS, these cells would then be able to go out and destroy those cancer cells throughout the body. For example, they could be useful to eradicate cancer cells that could be left over after surgery and prevent those cells from growing and causing recurrence of the tumor. So let's get to the lymph nodes, as you mentioned. So training these immune cells is a big challenge, and the lymph nodes, we believe, are the solution to that challenge. So the average person might not think about lymph nodes very much, but they're very important for the immune response. These are the primary sites in our body where the immune cells come together, where they exchange information with each other. They serve as training centers for the immune response. This is, in essence, where the immune cells coordinate all the activities that they need to perform to defend the body. So the strategy at Elicio is to get these types of treatments to the lymph nodes, and that has been a big challenge. Typically, these types of treatments, after they're dosed, they're diverted away from the lymph nodes, and so they might miss their chance to train those immune cells. But what we're doing at Elicio is developing a new class, a new type of treatment that are targeted directly to the lymph nodes, where we can train those immune cells more effectively. And this is something that has taken a lot of work. And the strategy that we've developed is based on albumin, this very common protein in the body, which has a very useful property in that it travels very specifically, precisely, into the lymph nodes. So we're looking with our approach to take advantage of this. And we can do that by engineering our treatments to attach to albumin after they're injected. And this allows us to directly target those treatments to immune cells in the lymph nodes. So the idea here is that once in the lymph nodes, those treatments can educate immune cells so they recognize the tumor, and those cells are able to patrol throughout the body, search wherever they find cancer cells, they're programmed to kill them, and do that specifically while leaving normal healthy cells untouched. And if we're able to do that, we've got a really good shot at treating cancer effectively.
So you're taking albumin, which we've all heard of, you know, is very common in the body, and you're engineering that signature onto the albumin. Then the albumin goes into the lymph node and says, hey, this is what you got to, the back end says, this is what you got to look for. That's what's making the T cell smart.
Yeah, that's exactly right. This is all about delivery. We have information that we want to get to the immune cells, and albumin is able to get that information directly into the place where the immune cells are where they are and where they can use that information to develop the right responses to treat cancer.
So you're also making smart albumin.
Well, albumin is already smart. We're just taking advantage of the things it knows how to do really well.
All right. We're there. Now, I know you're in phase two for pancreatic cancer. Every phase two started with a phase one. Let's take us back there so we know what you did in phase one, who you looked at, the humans you looked at, what you tested, and what you learned.
Yeah, so love to do that. The phase one trial was looking at 25 patients with pancreatic and colorectal cancer, a group that is in significant need of new therapies. These patients had already been through the standard treatments. So in this case, that's chemotherapy and surgery to remove their tumor. And after that, they're evaluated using medical imaging to understand the state of their cancer. We're essentially looking to see if we can find any tumor remaining. And for patients coming onto the trial, the answer there was no. The scans didn't show anything. We can't see a tumor. But this is a big but. When we look with that more sensitive ctDNA blood test, we see the tumor. We're able to see that those tumor cells are still present. And unfortunately, this means that the cancer is likely to return, and at that point to progress really quickly. So with this information, what we asked was, can we treat those patients to eliminate the remaining tumor cells that we detected with the ctDNA test? And by doing that, could we potentially prevent the cancer from returning? So that's exactly what we tried to do. And we saw some really interesting things. So the first thing we saw was the immune response. We, in this case, wanted to count, essentially to count the number of tumor-killing immune cells that were present in these patients before and after the treatment. And what we saw was that after treatment, the number of immune cells was increased in the vast majority of the patients on the trial. So obviously this suggests that the treatment is doing a good job of training up those immune cells. After that, we wanted to see whether patients had reductions in the level of their ctDNA. And we saw that that was the case in many patients. In fact, almost a quarter of the patients completely cleared their ctDNA, which means it went to zero, undetectable. And so that is suggestive that the residual tumor cells that were present after surgery were being killed. And what's really exciting, the last thing we wanted to do was see whether the strength of the immune response, the number of immune cells, was in any way connected to how well patients did overall. And so what we did is we looked at the time that patients would take to relapse or to pass away from their disease and measured that against the strength of the T cell, the immune cell response. And what we saw was that there was an 86% decrease in the risk of recurrence of death or relapse in patients that developed the strongest, the best immune cells to our treatment. So this is obviously really exciting. And it shows that the treatment is both generating those immune cells, training them up, and that if patients get those types of responses in their immune system, it may be able to delay or prevent the return of their cancer. So obviously now our job is to confirm that in the phase two study.
And as happens in phase two, you look at what happened in phase one, and you don't just continue it. You say, okay, maybe we'll target this or maybe we'll change this. And so while you will at some point work on colorectal, you decided in phase two just to focus on the pancreatic cancer. Now, tell us what that is and how that's different.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So the phase one looked at both. We have to make a choice in phase two, and we chose to look at pancreatic cancer. And there's some good reasons for that. We know that pancreatic cancers are often mutated with this KRAS mutation, so they have the exact signature that the treatment was designed to address. So many patients with this type of cancer could benefit. We also know that pancreatic cancer is one of the deadliest cancers. It has a five-year survival of less than 20%, so patients are in very great need of new therapies. So in this trial, the phase two, we're again looking at pancreatic cancer patients, again looking at patients that have completed their standard treatments, either chemotherapy or surgery, or both most likely. And again, the standard approach here is observation. So doctors are just waiting. They're monitoring. They're looking for that tumor to return, and they know that it will. So in the trial, instead of just waiting, instead of just watching, we're going to look to see if this experimental treatment can delay or even completely prevent the return of the tumor. And again, because this is a phase two study, we'll have the opportunity to compare the outcomes in those patients, the ones that get the treatment, to those who receive the standard observation. And this will allow us to measure how well the treatment works.
And how many people are in that study?
Approximately 135. So patients will be split to either get treatment or to get observation. And then we'll be able to follow them again to look for the amount of time that it takes for patients to have a recurrence of their tumor or to pass away. And that will give us a chance to observe the benefits that we could potentially see with this treatment.
And if they're not getting Elicio's treatment, they're still getting all the other treatments that they were...
That's exactly right.
Designed to be given, yeah.
Exactly.
Okay. So no one is without treatment in this.
That's exactly right, yes.
That's great. Now, you keep saying if they got the treatment, is this a one-time delivery?
So the treatment is multiple doses. So we give four doses in the first month and two additional doses in the second month. And so this is the initiation, the first training session for the immune response, if you will. And then we give those immune cells a little bit of a break. And then we come back in and we train them again. We give them another four doses. So essentially another lesson, another session to learn the lessons that we're trying to teach them.
So, you know, this really is science. We have to figure out how much is too much, how much is too little, how much is enough. There are questions here.
Absolutely. Yes, there are tons of things we're still learning. One of the really interesting questions here is how many immune cells we need to be effective. also what sort of qualities or functions those cells need to have in order to be effective killers and finders of tumor cells in the body. And I think the biggest thing that we're most interested to study, and that's the main goal of the phase two, is, again, whether this type of treatment could prevent the cancer from returning, and if so, how long that protection might last.
So this starts out as a treatment because you're treating cancer that is present. And if it prevents it in the future, it becomes a vaccine.
That's exactly right. So this can prevent the return of cancer in the future, but it certainly starts out in your body as a treatment. And this is one of the most amazing things about the immune system, essentially that it has a memory, that it can remember the past dangers that it's experienced before. And this is really important because it means that the immune cells that remember can react more quickly to protect you from threats that you might see again in the future. So certainly while this treatment is designed to address cancer that's present now, the immune system can form that long-lasting memory, and it might be able to recognize future cancer cells and then prevent them from returning and causing the disease to progress. So it's certainly a really exciting opportunity to treat patients, but also to give them potentially really long-lasting and durable freedom from disease.
So any future cancer with a KRAS mutation, hopefully it would say you might be a completely different cancer, but we have you. But there are other mutations and other unique mutations.
Yeah, absolutely. There are many different mutations. Cancers are very diverse. So this is the type of therapy that could be used to target those other signatures of the tumor. And that's kind of the exciting part looking into the future. We're learning how to train these immune cells. We're teaching them how to see tumor cells, find them, and destroy them. We've worked really hard, and we're still working hard to overcome this challenge of getting to lymph nodes. And if we do that, it looks like we can really help to train the immune cells and equip them to do the right things and find and kill cancer. So as we learn more, as we understand more what makes a tumor tick, essentially, we can develop these types of treatments specifically for different types of cancers and go beyond even the KRAS cancers that we're treating right now.
Well, Dr. DeMuth, this has been terrific. I hope you'll come back and keep us updated.
I look forward to that, Moira. Happy to.
Dr. Peter DeMuth is the Chief Scientific Officer of Elicio Therapeutics, on the web at elicio.com. That's E-L-I-C-I-O, elicio.com. For Tech Nation, I'm Moira Gunn.
Tech Nation and its regular segment Biotech Nation are produced at the studios of KQED-FM in San Francisco. Executive producer is Matt Gardner. Our theme music was composed by Ann Nachtrieb-Zesiger and Robert Powell, with title creation provided by NameLab Incorporated of San Francisco. Program information and internet audio is available on the web at technation.com. Tech Nation and Biotech Nation are productions of Tech Nation Media. I'm Paul Lancourt.